This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers, and Interactive Brokers clients earn up to 3.83% on their uninvested, instantly available USD cash balances. And now, this is important, those balances can be FDIC insured up to $10 million through their program banks. IBKR's Insured Bank Deposit Sweep program will now provide up to $5 million of federal deposit insurance coverage on an individual or institutional account's free cash balances. And in addition, joint accounts are eligible for up to $10 million in coverage in free cash balances. How much interest is your broker paying you? Compare IBKR's rates to those of other banks and brokers that are offering less than, what, 0.5%? That's one reason smart investors use IBKR to trade stocks, options, futures, currencies, bonds, funds, and more. Strength also matters when choosing a broker. IBKR's financial stability and risk controls are designed to protect clients' assets in any market condition. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Rates, of course, are subject to change. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Compare how much you could earn at IBKR.com/interest rates.
The disciplined investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Blowing a hole in the debt ceiling. The unemployment numbers are out. Oil on the move and gold is kicking it. Making speculation great again, we say. And our guest is Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. All this and much more on episode number 924 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, how are you? Andrew Horowitz in your ear as you're listening to me or on your speaker for another what I would call probably going to be a great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Look, clearly the April showers that we saw a couple months ago brought those May flowers, and we saw U.S. equities bloom with the growth in tech sector leading the way and really coming back in a very strong manner from what was basically a bear market. And you got to wonder almost if that was a dog whistle somehow to those investors that finally got their wish that there was a down market and they could start investing. And then the short coverings happened. And then from there, we went into the FOMO trade. And here we are today, which some people are saying it could be a bear market bounce because, I mean, listen, valuations have returned to elevated levels. International equities are still outperforming dramatically. Investor sentiment has shifted dramatically. And what's happening right now is that markets, they appear at least to be brushing off these negative headlines, focusing instead on short-term optimism. And that's fine. There's this growing hope that the expiring tax cuts are going to be renewed, right? They're not going to allow them to roll off at the end of this year. And that the debt ceiling resolution is going to unlock additional fiscal stimulus. And that, I think, is something that we really need to focus on. And a lot of people really haven't done so because it's good and it's bad. There's two sides, maybe even three, when it comes to this particular circumstance with regard to the big, beautiful bill that's being put on and now through Senate and reconciliation, then it's going to eventually get approved probably. But one of the things that is very interesting that the assumption in all of this is that the tariffs, which we know or have been, well, the courts have said they're maybe not legal, but then they were stayed and now they're back on. But when this all flushes out, what if we put this bill into place with all this excessive spending and increase in the debt ceiling, et cetera, and the assumption that much of the hole is going to be clogged by some of these tariffs, which, by the way, are supposed to be just a negotiating tactic, which also is supposed to be maybe permanent now to a degree. All of this is this very three-dimensional chess game that you have to look at from an economic standpoint. Because the extra fiscal spending that is going to go on here, while it may support equities, it could create massive headwinds for bonds, especially as deficits continue to balloon. And with that, I think that there's an idea that in the air, there's this feeling that everything's going to be just fine, that tariffs are going to be just fine, that we're going to get this bill in, that who cares about the deficit? It doesn't really matter. There's an air of speculation. We're seeing that thinly traded instruments are getting a major bid, which is fine. I mean, that's what makes the markets move, right? Speculation. But now, once again, we're getting close to that 22 forward PE on the S&P 500. Kind of weird. In a time when markets are being led around by chaotic policymaking attempts. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time because I want to get to our guest today. And I know he's going to have a lot to talk about, so let's just stop right there. So we're going to get right to our guest. And Frank Curzio is an equity analyst with close to more than three decades of experience covering small and mid-cap stocks. You got to check out his newsletters. We're going to have him over on The Disciplined Investor, episode number 924, the show notes on disciplinedinvestor.com. He's been the editor of several well-respected newsletters with major companies, as well as on the top performers with thestreet.com, where he's outperformed. He's major. He worked with Jim Cramer side by side, which is a whole different discussion. He's the host of Wall Street Unplugged, a wonderful podcast, and he's been quoted all over the place from Fox and CNBC and Cramer's Mad Money. He's been guest on all sorts of things. He's been one of the top rankings in Holbert. The list goes on. Frank Curzio, again, always wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for the intro.
I wanted to start. I have so many things to talk to you about, as always. You and I go back a long, long time, actually, mm-hmm. 16, 17, 18 years. You and I have a lot of a similar approach to the idea of looking at things. Like, we want to look at the big picture, but then we really know that in the end of the day, it's the underlying small picture that really matters more importantly. But I want to start today with the big picture, mm-hmm. because everyone's seemingly all a flutter with the potential for inflation, worrying about jobs. Nothing problematic in a big way consistently, right? Little blips here and there. But consistently, nothing has really showed up that's like hysterically upsetting that I'm going to go outside and burn my house and go and find that bunker and live on canned food forever. Is there something that we need to worry about, or is this all a giant media scam?
I think you need to be worried, right? I don't know if you have to be worried so much about deficits. I love the fact that everyone's talking about them, but everyone's just talking about deficits and it's going to destroy our country. The dollar's going to lose its reserve currency status. If you do the research, you'll see it from like the mid-1970s until now, right? So the biggest thing to look at was deficits. It's great that we need to be nervous about it. It's great that it's being addressed. The only way out of it is through economic growth. And I think that's what Trump is trying to do with tariffs. Let's see if that works. But we need economic growth. And in order to have that, we need lower rates. And the Fed has a lot of ammo. But, if you're worried about our deficits and the dollar losing its reserve currency status, you got much, much bigger problems than losing a little money in the stock market. I mean, we're going to get taken over as a country. There's a lot of massive risks. So just be careful. Not only that, we'll see the writing on the wall when it comes to that big picture, because we'll see the bond spread yields. We saw it, right? The bond market started to get a little uneasy. And that's when Trump came out and said, hey, I'm going to reverse the tariffs for now. And we're just going to do reciprocal. It's going to be 10% of quick. Like, he pulled back tremendously because, thank God he has Bessent there saying, look, he tapped him on the shoulder and said, the bond market's telling us that, we're going to be in a lot of trouble right now. Everything's broken. The pipes aren't working. Nobody knows what's going on or what the rules are. If they have to move operations from Canada and Mexico into the U.S. So all that stuff, now that I'm not saying it's off the table, but, we have a good example of how it all worked in the Middle East, which is great. And I think that was a relief for the market. I think the fact that we're dealing with China, which is cool, and the back and forth with China is going to continue. So last week and stuff like that. But I think it's better for both countries that they get along. And, my biggest risks are interest rates going higher, but hopefully, the Fed's going to start cutting pretty soon. I think they need to start cutting with the latest, income numbers are very, very strong and inflation's down. That could change, Andrew, with some of these tariffs that we haven't seen. But, you know, we're looking at where oil prices are, and finally we're seeing home prices really level out where I'm not going to say the housing market's frozen, but we're going to need lower interest rates because that's going to hurt our economy. It's a very big part of the economy, and no one's really buying homes right now.
Well, let's talk about the bond scare that we had. Was that part of the taco trade?
The taco trade. I love that term.
For those of you who know, it's been something, I don't know who coined this, TACO, T-A-C-O acronym, because everything has to have an acronym, for Trump always chickens out. And in fact, he was approached last week or the week before, whatever it was, on this, and he got kind of, you know, aggravated about it. And I think that maybe there's something, let me tell you, if it was done by someone who was quote unquote against him, I think it was interesting that they're trying to get at him. If it was done that somebody's on his side, I think it was brilliant to push him to make sure that he stands his ground, by the way, because he put this kind of thing under his nose saying that, you know, Trump's a chicken. I think that he would react to that. But anyway, do we think that there's some of that at play, or was it, do you really think Bessent came in and said, because I think that's a fascinating thought process. If Bessent did come in and say, you know, hey, just lighten up for a second here. Let's just kind of see what happens, and then we can always go back. But let's not come in, you know, storm trooping, because it really is causing some upheaval.
Yeah, and Bessent, he's a rock star when it comes to this, whether you like him or not. I mean, he's part of Soros. He's part of the biggest trade. They say it's the greatest trade ever with Brexit and shorting UK market and stuff like that and currency. So he understands the currency markets, which is good. But what I do love is we have an example of what happens when this works. And when it worked and we were in the Middle East, I mean, they rolled out the red carpet for us. We had what? He had 10 companies with him. All of them signed new deals. It was massive, right? So everybody was happy. And what's the art of winning a deal is when you could both walk away and feel like you won. And even with China, when, you know, it's first disclosed, hey, we had good... So China went back and said, hey, look what we did to Trump, and we held our ground. And we came back and said, look, we signed a deal with China. When both parties could walk away on good terms, now you're getting all these deals signed. You're seeing, you know, AI go into the Middle East, and it was this huge spectacle for the market. It was great. I felt like even, you know, getting along with China takes recession risk off the table. But think about what's coming up, because that's going to be with every UK nation. And I think what we have to realize is whether, you know, we're in the U.S.
What's every UK nation?
Not every European nation. Okay. So, I mean, we're going to be signing deals. Sorry about that. We're going to be signing deals with every single one of them. And we're going to see the same thing. We're probably going to see the same thing with Canada. We're going to see the same thing maybe in South American countries, right? Maybe even with Russia. So the fact that this happens is all good on the economic front. It is very positive. And those are lots of catalysts because, look, we're the superpower, right? And it's not that we're pounding our chests, but I'd rather be the people that are the richest than the people who supply everything, because we can get it. Anything we want from other countries. Will we pay a little bit more? Yes. That's why people are worried about inflation. But the fact that we have the strongest economy gives us a lot of leverage where we want the tariffs to be fair. And we realize on both sides that the tariffs are not fair. So let's make them fair. And everyone that actually, you know, I don't want to say bend the knee, which is wrong, but you come to terms, it's great for their economy. It's great for our economy. And you take a lot of risk off the table. And that's going forward over the next 12 months. I think you're going to see a lot of those deals getting signed. That's going to be a positive for the markets in general, along with once they're signed, we're seeing inflation come down a little bit. We know that it's up tremendously and it's still going higher, right? And everyone's feeling their pockets. But when you have energy coming down, home prices coming down, two major components of CPI, you're going to see that holding at what? 2.1, 2.3, 2.4%, that gives Powell the go-ahead to start lowering rates, which I think we're going to see in September. I really do think we're going to see that in September. So when we're lowering rates and then we see these deals signed with tariff for the next 12 months, and then you throw in with all of the deregulation with banks and the amount of money they have on their balance sheet that they can never lend out because of, you know, laws that were put in place during the credit crisis, you have a lot of catalysts going forward. Doesn't mean we're not going to have ups and downs, but... You know, interest rates, I think, is the biggest risk here. That's what I'd be worried about from the macro front. And I think that's going to push Powell to actually lower rates later this year.
I'm going to hold you because you said a mouthful right there. And I want to go back and reel this back to the discussion of trade deficits, because I've been thinking about this for the last number of weeks. And I talked about this probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And then I actually heard somebody talking about this also. I'm thinking, did they steal that from me? But the idea that I have a trade deficit, I have a huge trade deficit with Amazon. You know, Amazon... you know, they don't need me, but I need them. And Amazon provides me a tremendous opportunity to benefit myself from the standpoint of, let's call it pricing, convenience, time, you know, the laundry list of things that go on, right? And is that a bad thing? Now, translate that to a trade deficit with, I don't know, let's talk about Indonesia, Bangladesh, South America, South Africa. Is it really necessarily a bad thing that I'm buying the stuff? They talk about the chips versus the chips. Like, I want to export and be the creator and the person that gets the money on computer chips, but I don't really give a crap about creating potato chips.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this deficit thing, I find this to be a bit of a red herring.
I don't know. I mean, think about it. So if everyone was in your place and everyone said, you know, Amazon decides to raise prices, what are you going to do?
And they have. That's a problem. I agree with that.
But say if Amazon raised prices, they're going to lose a lot of their customers. That's bad for Amazon. And what are you going to do? You're going to get your stuff from someplace else, mm-hmm. right? It's going to be a little bit more expensive. So Amazon I would put Amazon in kind of the metaphor as being every other country, right? So yes, it's nice to get cheap products from China. It's nice to get cheap products from Vietnam and Taiwan and stuff like that, whatever. But the bottom line is if they're raising prices or if they don't comply with tariffs, we could, just like you would do at Amazon, you might pay a little bit more, but you might go someplace else if this continues. And that's the threat. Now, what happens to Amazon? Amazon's going to get destroyed. What happens to these countries? They're going to get destroyed. If you don't have America buying all of their products that they're producing for cheap, what's going to happen to them? And then you throw in China. What's the catalyst in China? Everyone was buying China because of this massive stimulus. By the way, they've been stimulating the economy for the last 2 years. Right. And they're like the bazooka stimulus. They've lowered their reserve requirements tremendously. And it hasn't done nothing because they're in a deflationary environment. And believe me, I have great contacts in China. It's 10 times worse than what everyone believes. However, the reason why you have Tepper and a lot of others, they say, well, okay, you're going to see growth come back. Now with the tariffs, when we were arguing with them back and forth, it took the only thesis to buy China off the table. They're not going to grow now. And now they have to deal with the massive deficits, their real estate collapsed. They just had their largest real estate developer a mm-hmm. month ago report its biggest loss it's ever seen in 21 years. Mm-hmm. It's still a disaster over there.
Right.
So the only way they get out of that is if they continue to produce and people are buying their products. It makes sense for both sides to sign this deal. So I hear you, but you know, I think right now that we have a playbook where I was a little worried. I didn't think Trump would try to do this to every country at the same exact time, and I was caught off sides. But we did add to a lot of positions on the way down, and we're doing absolutely great now.
We'll talk about that in a second. So I want to know about specific areas and all. But again, to reel back on this, you know, you look at what was the developer? The country something, not Countrywide, Country, Grand Country, whatever it is, Green something. Anyway, all the developers. And the point of what happened with China's real estate and the bubble they created. I told you this many years ago. Yep. I was there. The ghost cities are real. I mean, really real, you know, where they're just built to build. That's the bottom line. They're just built to build. And that collapsed. Why? Well, because it was inevitable. The problem was that the Chinese investor got the rug pulled because they were told this is how you should be investing. You should be buying houses. They buy property as their retirement, right? Where we go in our 401ks and we buy stocks and things like that. They basically got the rug pulled out from them. And now there's a distrust on that by the average Chinese investor. And that's a problem for them long-term on that front. And their banks are attached to that. And that collapsed. You know, the whole thing was really built on a house of cards, right?
I mean, to me, when I look at China, what has China provided us? I mean, they steal our IP, right? Our technology, they hack our systems. They lie about the numbers all the time. The fentanyl problem that they have. I mean, there's so many negatives there that I think have been ignored for such a long time. But a lot of these things, there's so many things that could be done under the table, I think, with this deal where, okay, China can go back and say, hey, we beat Trump and we won. Or we can go back and say, hey, we have a deal with China. And I told you, you know, we're stronger than them and Trump. And they could both brag, which they love to do. But under the table, there's so much that could be done to make this work because we both need each other. So hopefully that happens.
That's a great point, by the way, Frank. I think that goes, you know, you look at some of the people that are the China hawks. And I think they miss the point. Or they're just unwilling to accept the point that we need each other. That's an important factor. First of all, we created China and what they are today. Mm-hmm. I've said this. If I said that once, I've said it 1,000 times. We created and did what we did with Japan back in the day. Remember, made in Japan? Remember that whole thing?
Yeah.
You know, then it was now made in China. Next is going to be made in Vietnam. We make these things because we don't want to make this stuff. We don't want to make shirts. We don't want to be in a factory. We don't want to be sweating. We want to sit in a comfy chair and just click on a keyboard and maybe influence somebody through a social media. That's how we want to make our money.
And it's funny. I mean, even if you look, I don't want to get, this is a deeper discussion, but even with the climate change, like we're all into, you know, Europe's over the top with it. We've seen with the highest electricity prices in the world, and that's, and their economy has grown, I think over the past 20 years, pretty much 10 times slower than the US. I think even more slower than China over the past 20 years because of very high electricity costs and green efforts and stuff like that. But, you know, we talk about it, but we're talking about global, and yet we're like, no, but China can produce as much coal as they want. The rare earth metals. I mean, I don't know if you, the batteries that they're producing, I mean, the massive amount of CO2, if you look at it, we're kind of okay with China doing it. This way we don't have to deal with it maybe on the political scale. But the fact that we do that and taking politics out of it makes us need China because we need rare earth metals, right? So if we definitely need each other, and we need each other probably the same. You could say one needs more than the other, whatever. If you're from the U.S., you're like, oh, we own China. If you're China, they're like, we own the U.S., forget about politics. It's about your wallet. We need each other. If that deal goes down, it's going to be very good for the economy. It's going to be very good for the global economy. And I think, you know, that could provide another leg up for stocks going forward.
Yep. I want to talk to you about some of the things you talk about. Just one more thing I want to peel back again, what you talked about the dollar and some of the things you've talked about in the past also on this show, as well as on Wall Street Unplugged. Then I want to get into some of your research. I want to get into how you do it. We really never got into the nitty gritty there and talk about some names, but let's take a quick break and come right back. I'm going to talk about Interactive Brokers, of course, because, you know, you want to do things like navigate political uncertainty, right? What happens? Well, disciplined investors, they don't panic. They prepare. At Interactive Brokers, you can help protect your portfolio and even hedge market risk with bonds, precious metals, and even foreign exchange, all from one powerful platform. With advanced tools, global access, and low costs, IBKR helps you manage volatility and stay ahead, even in uncertain times. The best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. To learn more, visit ibkr.com/navigate. I will be back with my very dear friend, Frank Curzio, who I haven't seen in a long time, and we keep on promising each other that we will, but like things like kids, work, family seem to get in the way.
Craziness.
Maybe when we're old and gray, we can go somewhere together, do something. We got to find a business reason to actually go somewhere. I guess Vegas is the point.
Vegas always works.
I got a meeting with Frank in Vegas. What are you talking about? It's business. So I want to kind of go back to what we were talking about a moment ago and the discussion of something you've said and you've commented back. I went back and I looked at some of the archives from 2023, and you talked about it on this show, also Wall Street Unplugged, which again is a great podcast. People should make sure to get that. The idea that other countries are actively, they're involved on a regular basis of trying to figure out the way to replace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency, which I think has a little bit, you know, what does that exactly mean, right? The world's reserve currency. It's kind of the go-to in the event of. It's the place that certain commodities are priced in. It's the currency that pretty much is universal, right? Bitcoin and all that has been tried over the years. How real is that threat? And what, if it did materialize, if it is a threat, you know, what does that actually mean?
It's zero threat.
All right, so there you go.
It's zero threat. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in our lifetimes. And Trump's going to make sure it doesn't happen, because if anybody does try and you get other countries trying to have their own, you know, central bank digital currency, he's going to stop dealing with them, right? And that gives us that power. Because if you look back even with the gold standard, you know, what Nixon did was one of the greatest things for our country. If you're a gold bug, you hate it. And they bring it up and they say, oh, he took us off the gold standard. Well, we did that because we didn't have gold to pay for the dollars when people, it was like this one-to-one, right? So he saw it coming and it was going to hurt our country tremendously. And then he signed this amazing deal to say, hey, you know what? The dollar is now the reserve currency and it made our country extremely strong. And when we say the reserve currency of the world, just take out a dollar and pay in another country, everybody's going to take it. But if you do that, they might take euros. Other than that, you know, that's where the universal currency, everybody wants dollars, right? So, you know, the guarantee by our government, we've always paid our bills. And yes, the deficits are out of control. I know the numbers. Believe me, I'm a numbers guy. $34 trillion, I get over $1 trillion interest costs. But we're going to see spreads. We'll see it in the spreads if this thing blows up. There's, you know, the Fed has a lot of ammo because I cannot believe this. And you and I, you know, look at the economy all the time, that the Fed, you know, we're supposed to be lowering rates right now. And if you would have told me that the market would be doing this well, and yes, we had a nice pullback, but the market's doing this well, the economy's doing this well, income levels are going up. You know, we're spending more, we're seeing retail. I mean, we're not seeing this ultimate collapse, even in the housing market where interest rates were what? Your mortgage rates is 3.25, whatever, under 4% now, whatever, they're close to 7. You know, if you would have told me that he didn't have to touch interest rates and we'd still have this economy, I'd be like, you're absolutely out of your mind, right? So we have a lot of leverage there to lower rates to help that out. But losing that reserve currency status, it's a great story. And most of the people are pitching and are trying to sell you something. And the funny thing is that they're selling you, like a newsletter product or something, which if that happens, everything is going to crash. We're in a different environment. It's World War III. That's where our military comes in and the protection of the military, all this stuff with our dollar, which makes us strong. You know, Trump really understands that. Okay. Whether you like him or not, that was really big to him, where we were just, I think we were empowering China so much. We didn't even care what they did. We hated Russia because we don't have no ties to Russia. We have lots of ties to China. Right. So, you know, when I look at the whole thing and the whole scheme of things, it's a great story to tell. The numbers are insane when you look at them, but you only have to worry about debt when you're not paying your bills. And we've always paid our bills and we're still doing that. With China, why do we worry? Why the last few years? Because it started to default on a lot of stuff. When you see that, just like we saw during the credit crisis, we saw that in 2006, Andrew. People just didn't want to pay attention. And then you had the Fed coming out saying, everything's fine. We're good. No, the housing market's fine. We could withstand this or whatever, because they didn't know that they would leverage 34-1.
Which is a whole different discussion. Debt. We don't even want to talk. How did they not know that?
How do they not know that? But, you know, for now, there will be writing on the wall where you'll see it and you're not seeing it right now. So, you know, again, it'll keep you up at night and that's fine. For me, it's not really a concern because, you know, again, you and I will see that coming. We'll see the cracks in the foundation and there's not cracks right now.
Yeah. So with regard to, the point you make about the newsletters, because you write a newsletter. That's a big part of what you do. That is what you do. Mm-hmm. It occurs your research. And what's interesting is a lot of newsletters are this, this end of world, we're about to enter some kind of purgatory or some kind of financial ruin. And that's not your style. I mean, yeah, you'll talk about some negatives, but you have a lot more research that goes into it, as opposed to trying to stimulate from, you stimulate the positive, I find, not the negative. There's a difference. And let's kind of go through some of that. So first I want to ask you, and I'll get to that because I got it written down as a note that I want. Mm-hmm. You've interviewed, I don't know, hundreds of market experts, right? And aside from the brilliant conversations that I've had on your show, put that aside for a second. what conversations and what people have stuck with you the most and kind of give us a little bit of a understanding why?
What do you mean, like my clients and stuff?
No. Who on your podcast has been like, wow, that's been a great convo. You know, what a great insight. If you could remember any of them.
We've interviewed, you know, heads of state. We've interviewed, pretty much most of the people that you've seen on CNBC I've interviewed, and I think what you do a great job of too is, you know, you listen, right? And for me, like, we'll have a script and it's not a script, but I'll have questions and things like that I'm asking these people. And it's just sometimes something will come up and this is going to get to your question in a second, but sometimes things come up and that's the conversation. You know, how many times you see people interviewing the president or interviewing and they have like a list of questions and they're talking to the president. And as the president's answering a question, they're looking at their sheet to see what question that, like, listen to him, because he's going to say something that could direct the whole conversation. So when that happens and you really do your homework on the people that you're interviewing, it's these people love coming on the show because they know it's like, Andrew, if someone's coming, so someone's researching you and they're going to do an interview. And then all of a sudden they ask you about your cookout. You're going to be like, holy cow, man, this guy did a lot of research on me. This is awesome.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that was great. I wish it would have been that. Right. But that's the thing. So, you know, a lot of these guys just love coming on the show. And what that's done with you and I, we've been doing this for so long. We have two of the longest standing podcasts. I mean, when did we start these things? I mean, holy cow, it's over 15 years now, I think. The benefit to us, and people say, well, it's a free podcast. The benefit to us is, one, you establish your whole business. I established my whole business. I mean, we generated pretty much close to $25 million in about 6-7 years through my podcast.
Wow. Wow.
You know, I'm not saying that's money that went into my pocket, right? That's hiring employees, building the company, spending, raising money, you know, so, but it's incredible what you could do. And the context that we have globally, my podcast, Wall Street Unplugged, and yours too as well, it goes up to, I think, 125 countries. Yeah. That's downloaded in. So you're getting information all over the world, every place, like real-time information. And just, you know, so the guests also provide me with great insights and great ideas into lots of industries. But that's where the credibility comes from. It's just, you know, not, you know, arguing with them or being pissed off at them, but just learning from them. If they have a different opinion, good. Like, you should welcome that. If someone could change your mind about something you feel so strongly about, welcome that. Be, you know, you want to get smarter. That's what the whole world's about. The next generation is getting smarter and smarter. And I think so many people are stubborn in their ways, especially in the newsletter industry. And I don't know if I'm just going around, you know, your question here, but yeah, you know, it's like people are like, you got to buy gold no matter what. Not true. You know, maybe the last year and a half. Yes, I love gold. You should own a small piece of gold, but gold should not be your whole portfolio. Just like Bitcoin shouldn't be your whole portfolio. So, you know, there's times to buy certain things and times not to, but people who are just stubborn in their ways, like, you know, dollar's going to lose his reserve currency status. You could play something from the early 1980s and it's the same exact conversation, the same people that are saying it today who are like,
Peter Schiff, sorry.
You know, there's a lot more too. There's a lot more. I mean, greatest marketer ever. I give him credit. Great marketer. Hopefully you're not, you know, if you did the opposite.
He hits that niche. That of people that like the echo chamber and are going to love what he has to say and all that. So that's good. God bless him. I've had him on many times.
The only problem I have with him is people look at him for like they follow him in terms of what they're doing with their money. And I think you just got to realize that guy's an entertainer. And if you realize he's an entertainer, you take a step back. That's fine. But you know, when you see a guy that's unperformed, that has probably the worst trade that you'll ever see in the history since the market's, you know, hundreds of years, saying Bitcoin's going to zero, and it's literally 105,000 over 100,000, and he's still saying it's going to zero. You know, that's, you want to avoid those type of people, because when the facts change, you need to change. And the facts, especially when technology and Bitcoin and everything going on, things change right away. You got to be willing to change.
That's an important lesson right there. That is the most overlooked one of them. That piece, if you could just, listeners, if you could just take that piece of what Frank just said, that you need to change when the information or the facts change. Mm-hmm. And the inability for people to do that. And by the way, I will put myself in that camp sometimes until sometimes you get a kick in the head by the horse, right? You know, you got to be, it's like, wait a second. You're telling me that, you know, this is a good investment. It was, you know, for example, you know, a classic would be like Amazon from the day one. Oh, that's not going to do well. You know, that there is no way that a book selling swapping what? No. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that and you keep that as, you know, fast forward 20 years and you're like, no, what do you mean? It's a bookseller. Hello. No.
Netflix was
same thing.
Sending you DVDs in the mail.
The red jacket ones. Yeah, I remember those.
You know, those? So, yeah.
All right. Let's talk about, oftentimes you talk about this concept of boots on the ground research. Mm-hmm. And tell me about a time when, and tell me when what that is and how that gives you an edge over, let's say, I don't know, just general Wall Street consensus.
It gives me a huge edge. One, I enjoy it, right? So a good example is a company, I'll give this one away, we recommend it in a paid newsletter. It's called Prairie Operating. Okay, it's under $4. This is a company that was $9. Nobody really heard of it. And they have very big backers where they were doing 3,000 barrels of oil per day, which is not a lot. And now they actually raised money and did a $600 million acquisition for a company that had a market cap of $120 million, right? So you would normally do something like that within an IPO or maybe a SPAC and, you know, you're buying a company. But so it's so weird to see that. But what happened is the financiers and the people that bought this company said, hey, we have someplace in the middle of Denver, DJ Basin, where we could buy a ton of these wells. They're owned by private equity firms that have been getting killed because the price of oil has come down tremendously. And they went in and they purchased a ton to the point they're going to be producing over 25,000 barrels of oil per day. Now, what happened is this happened 3 months ago, and the financing part was difficult because everything started crashing. So the stock got crushed from like $9 and it came down. They had to provide better terms. One of the terms was in terms of the finances, and the financiers was Citigroup, you know, Johnson Rice, Truist, a lot of big names, like 10 of them, $600 million of big financing, especially for a small company. So they said, look, we need some guarantee. We need you to hedge your oil production. And they happened to hedge their oil production for this year at $68 a barrel. It's 60. Next year's is 65, 85% of the barrels are hedged, meaning that if oil goes to $10, they're still going to be generate massive amount of cash flow, right? So people don't know about the situation. And what I did is I went down to Denver to see their operations and I went right to their drilling site. And it's not only to meet the CEO, because every CEO, your job is to be positive. My job, your job.
Did you wear like a helmet and boots? Seriously.
Did you oh, you got to see it. I'll send you the picture. It's hilarious.
You got to see the picture. I have with the glasses. You got the glasses on. I see this.
I looked good. I'm not going to tell you that three people had helped me get the suit off.
I can see this.
But it was pretty tight. I'll send you the picture. You can put it on your site. But yeah, so you're going there and now it's not just talking to the CEO, but you're looking at sentiment for the workers as well. And they were really drilling. They're fracking site, right? So they're still drilling. They're going to frack a little while. And they have these pipes going in this massive drilling rig. They're drilling 11 wells. They have the crews there of like, you know, 50, 60 different people, different companies. It was incredible just to see the operations going on. But everybody was so positive. And then at night, like I went out and I went out with like, not the directors or not the, you know, the CEOs or not the executives, but like the next tier of managers, and just hung out with them and had a couple of beers. And they're like, you know, I just moved my family here from wherever, you know, from the Eagle Ford or something. This is the best opportunity. I've been with the company for a year. I mean, these guys really get it. The growth that we're going to see. When you see that, you see sentiment and you're a part of that and being there in person, it's a big deal. And this stock fell to under four. I mean, either the stock's going to go higher, they're going to produce so much revenue going forward from all this oil. Again, that's locked in at a certain price, and people don't really know this story yet because a lot of the firms that provided the research didn't come out with their coverage yet, only two or three of them, and they have $16, $15, $16 stock price on targets, and the stock's under four, so PROP. So, yeah, this is a name that, for me, I wanted to see in person. I wanted to meet the management team in person. I want to see the workers in person, and when you see the sentiment of workers. And I've been part of these companies that if you're old enough, man, I never thought I'd say if you're old like me, but I'm over 50 now. If you've been at companies and the culture goes bad, the companies, it's like a virus, right? And it's so difficult to change. You almost have to rip the Band-Aid off, get rid of everything. When you have your culture good, everyone's focused on the big picture and everyone's working together, and that's what you see. It usually results in a really, really good company. When people are happy to work there and they love it and things are going on and you're looking at the fundamentals, which anyone could look at, I could provide, that's what I do. It's what's the story behind it? Where are you going to see the growth from? And this is an oil company that's going to grow tremendously because they hedge their production, and it's a company I think is going to go a lot higher. So, you know, I like going boots on the ground where I see these projects. I visit every single shale area with Eagle Ford, Permian, and I've been through these different counties, which counties produce, the price they produce at different counties, and learning the technology. And just for me, that I love it because you're always learning something. And when you and I take a step back, everyone that listens to this podcast, I really believe this, is a specialist at something, right? So yes, I can give you the stocks and everything, but you know, my plumber's a genius. My mechanic's a genius. I don't know how to do that stuff. My electrician's a genius. So, you know, when you have everyone together bringing in something, it is amazing because I could go visit these companies and I've had vice presidents that work at Caterpillar saying, hey, this is what we're doing right now. You know, expanding here, doing this, you know, public information, but you know, having that network and then being able to see these people and talk to them, it provides this network that you and I have been building for, you know, decades. And it's extremely powerful. And, you know, that's where the trust factor comes in because, you know, and a lot of times I'll put my money behind these things. So if I'm losing or the stock goes down, I'm going to probably lose more money than 95% of you. And I really think that's the way it should be.
Yeah. Well, you're not losing, but yes.
No, but in our newsletter industry.
You're talking about skin in the game is what you're saying.
Yeah, and so that's where our industry, you asked about that. And our industry has really gone to shit. Sorry to curse on your podcast. I mean, my dad's been in this industry, my late dad for 30 years. I grew up in this industry at the kitchen table talking to him. And now it's all about marketing. It's all about just how do we get the best idea out? They have massive marketing conferences and they don't even talk about the customer. They're just like, how do we get, you know, AI out to more people? And, you know, they don't even care about the stocks they're recommending. They just want to bring in revenue, right? And sell this thing. That's why you see, you know, the deficits and the dollar's going to lose its reserve currency staff. You don't protect your money. Get it out of the country. Well, I mean, you've heard that for how many years,
the latest
right?
one, too, is you have the guy from Chaikin. Mark Chaikin, is that the one on TV lately? Talking about, you know, how all these, was it Mark Chaikin? Yeah, it's him, right? How he built this.
Analytics. Oh, yeah, that guy. Listen, a good example.
A lot of money, though, in those commercials. A lot of money to make those commercials.
Massive, but he's been calling for, you know, this Chuck Analytics saying, you know, get out of NVIDIA forever for like 3.5 years, right? Yeah. And why? Because they're getting clicks off of it. Even though if you did that, you got annihilated. I mean, you probably did okay, but it went to 140 before it went below 100. Now it's back over 140. You know, so they're not sending you that to try to help you. They know that you're going to click and then you're going to buy stuff. So when you look at our industry, and by the way, 90% of the players in our industry can't own anything that they're recommending in their newsletter. Meaning that when they tell you a stock's going to go up 40 times and it's going to happen within a year or 6 months, they can't own that. And that's different from what we do. And they do that for policy concerns, and this way they don't have to track everyone and stuff like that. And I get it because they're much larger. But when you think about that, why would they give away something they really think is going to go up 40X? And why wouldn't they, don't they want it to benefit their family? Why wouldn't they buy it themselves? So they can't even own that stuff. And that's a big difference what we do at Kersey Research, where a lot of these things I'm recommending, I own myself. So when they don't work out, you know, I'm getting nailed. But when they do work out, I'm going to do very well. I've done very well over my career. You know, so, but I think you should always have skin in the game and follow people that have skin in the game. Because a lot of people that are giving you that theory that, the, you know, you got to own gold in it. They don't own a lot of gold. You know, how much gold does Peter Schiff hold? I don't know. He should own billions of dollars, but I bet you he doesn't, right? Or Bitcoin's going to crash. Has he shorted Bitcoin? Because if he has, he'd be in a park bench, but he's telling everyone to get the hell out of Bitcoin. Yep. So, you know, when you own it, even with during the credit crisis, I had no problem with Lehman and Dick Fold. I mean, most of his wealth was tied into that company. He went down. I had no problem with that. It's the guy that creates that, you know, $5 billion hedge fund using the energy industry, blows it up completely because it's everyone else's money. And then the following 3 weeks later, he starts a new fund and raises a whole bunch of money. Those are the guys you got to be careful
about. Well, the thing is on them, right, for giving him more money. The next round. The first round is whatever. But the next round after a blow up or a closing down of a hedge fund because they haven't met the high watermark to create a new hedge fund. So that they have a new lowered watermark to get their 2 and 20 or the 20. Pretty fascinating. But that's beyond the scope of our discussion. But it's pathetic.
And real quick, Andrew, I think the reason why people listen to our podcast is because Wall Street is set up, and I'm not going to curse you, I'll say to screw retail investors. That's what happened with SPACs. It only works if you have this massive retail investor that's going to buy all this crap at 10.
No, that's not here you go. Say it. Go, say it.
No, just say Wall Street is...
Wall Street, you know, all the...
Oh, there we go. I love it. But it's set up to F you, right? So, and it is, it's true. And it's horrible, but a lot of, I think people don't realize that. And I think that's why Bitcoin is so strong is because it's one of the first times I can remember in my career, 30 years plus, where the average investor was actually right and beat Wall Street. And you had all these hedge funds. You have Jamie Dimon. You have so many people saying it's going to go to zero. It's going to go to zero. It's horrible. It's terrible. And they got in it and look where it is now. And now you're seeing them follow the retail investor. It almost never happens in our market. And I don't think that's, you know, any coincidence other than there's more networking. There's more people have access to information now. There's a lot, you know, you get information out a lot quicker. But, you know, when I'm looking at Wall Street and they're always trying to screw you, I think everyone wants to learn how to invest. You want to own assets, but it's hard to find people you trust. If you find people that you trust, stay with them. But you have to earn that trust. And that's what we've done over the past 30 years where we've never screwed our investors. And, you know, we're open and honest when we have our mistakes and we learn from them. I'm competitive as hell. I, you know, focus on my mistakes more than the winners. But, you know, that's what you need is to follow somebody that really cares about the customer first because Wall Street's about caring about themselves first. And even our business, it kind of sucks. With the newsletter industry, the last 10 years has really taken a nosedive down. It's really sad. But, you know, it's probably why we're getting a lot of business and traffic's really exploding for all of our products and things like that now.
Yeah. That's great. I think that I think the cream rises to the top, and the sediment comes to the bottom. Is I think a consolidation of that discussion.
Yeah.
You know. So now, when you are working on finding something like this prop, this Prairie company that you go to and you put on the skinny suit and bulge out of, but when you go there and what was the process to identifying these kind of under the radar opportunities?
Well, the process is when I'm looking at the company and I see things. So what happened with this company when they did the $600 million acquisition, none of their numbers would show up on Bloomberg yet. And none of the numbers show up on Capital IQ or all the systems. So when you're looking at a stock, you have no idea what's really going on. And there's no analyst coverage on it yet. Because once they provide the financing, and they're only going to provide the financing if they're, and, you know, they'll provide the financing because they're going to get paid. And then that deal is, we're going to come out and research. And it usually takes a month later. So when I looked at you know, this company and understood the numbers, because it's what I do, I was like, this is amazing. You know, I love the stock at 5 or 6, and I was just watching it. And it went all the way down below 4 because they, you know, it was a little, they didn't have trouble raising the money, but the terms, you know, changed and the market came down, and that's okay. That happens sometimes. But for me, then I'm calling contacts. I have someone who works at the firm that's really cool that actually alerted this to me a while ago. And then he said, look, we're having this, you know, tour and analyst tour and stuff like that. You should go. We're going to go in the field and really go into this. And I said, that gives me an opportunity. So it's me looking at a company first and seeing everything that checks off. And the more positive I am in it, the more I want to meet them because I want to find out when I'm wrong. Because me, what I've learned in the past 30 years, the more conviction I have, the more I have to worry. Right. So, that happens a lot. Cause I'm like, okay, change my mind. What am I not seeing on this? You know, and sometimes, you know, people provide, and I'm like, okay. And it talks me off the ledge a little bit where I might not take a big position, but that's one of the things I look at. And a good example is CoreWeave. So CoreWeave just came out, and they came out with their first earnings results, and the stock went up immediately, then fell below $60 a share. Right. And this is a company that just came out. Now,
just came out as an IPO, just to be clear.
As an IPO.
And it was the hottest one that was being propelled by all sorts of great sentiment on Wall Street, et cetera. And, you know, the tech, the AI, the storage, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And it winded up coming down, right? So it came down after the earnings. Now, this is their first earnings call. And is so you just had companies that provided the financing for this company, which is a very big multi-billion dollar company. They just provided the financing for this company. So, and they were the underwriters. Now, when they came out with earnings, what happens with earnings? So when earnings come out at night, that night you're going to see pretty much, if Amazon comes out, you're going to see 80% of the analysts have a report, and then they'll have a more detailed report in the morning. No reports came out on CoreWeave, and no reports came out in the morning because it's a relatively new stock. And when I listened to the CEO and I went over the numbers myself, I was fascinated. And we went on a podcast and said, look, this is a $100 stock, guys. You need to buy it. I didn't think it would happen 5 days later. You know, I really didn't. And I'll say that. But it was, when you look at what they're capable of, they said on their call that they can get the greatest chips that NVIDIA provides, Blackwell's, at scale, which means you have unlimited power to buy, right? You have this unlimited power where all the hyperscalers that have tens of billions of dollars on the balance sheet, you have Amazon spending $100 billion just on AI. They're spending the top four or five hyperscalers are spending more than $350 billion this year. And now you have CoreWeave that's providing the best chips with their infrastructure, and they're in very high demand. Well, what are the risks? The risk with the debt. The CEO went on and said, look, we only take on debt after we sign a contract. So if we sign, he put it there, he went on CBC. He goes, look, if we sign a contract, say for $200, we'll take out $100 of debt. And then through that contract, we'll pay off the debt, but we make sure that that contract's in hand first. And that's what we do. So when you look at their backlog is $29 billion and their market cap was $25 billion. And they had $19 billion in debt. So people were concerned. But that debt is only taking place because they have that backlog. So when I saw that you're taking that risk off the table and they have something that the richest companies in the world are dying for, demand is going to be off the charts and it's probably going to go a lot higher, right? So, you know, you want to look at disconnects in the market, not so much saying the S&P is going higher or the Dow, maybe it's time to buy small caps. Try to look at individual names because I'm seeing bigger disconnects than I've ever seen in the market right now and stuff like, again, I said it's got $100 stock. I didn't think it was going to happen 5 days. I thought it happened a little bit longer. But just the dynamics for a stock like that, where $25 billion market cap, you know, and you have $29 billion in backlog, that should command at least you're looking at close to $100 billion. If it's comparable to everyone else trading in the space, the stock should have been 4X higher. And it's only gone 2X higher since then. So, you know, things like that is what I look at when I'm trying to find good ideas and stuff like that. And sometimes I'm able to just go, when it's small caps, they'll roll out the red carpet for me and you go there and, you're able to really see everything within the company, and that's where the boots on the ground research comes in.
So that goes hand in hand with which I think you have had a history of being pretty vocal about market mispricing, media narratives, and kind of going and doing the work to, I hate that phrase, the work. You do the research. I don't like the work. We did the work. You know, it's like, it sounds really like a lot. What'd you do? Did you have to, were you picking things up? I mean, was it like, did you have to load it in a truck? You know, it's like, I find that terrible. Anyway, you did the research, and you dug in to understanding more about what was going on, rather than was just seemingly on a two-dimensional piece of paper. And that's the point, right? That's the point of where a lot of times investors maybe get it wrong. You're going, as you say, I think, what is it? We go behind the scenes. What is the story? We're on Wall Street Unplugged, where we go behind the scenes and.
Wall Street to Main Street.
We bring Wall, yeah.
That's what we try to do. Like another example is this. So what I do is I always focus on, you know, and it's probably not healthy, but when I make mistakes, I really dig into why did I get this wrong? And one thing I got wrong early in my career is, you know, not buying Netflix. And Netflix is trading at 100 plus PE, just like Microsoft was, just like Apple was. They all had 100 PEs at one time, right? And now they're, you know, in market, like, because they filled into that growth. And everyone said to avoid it. It's too expensive. And that helped us buy Palantir in the teens. in the newsletters. Mm-hmm. And people are like, well, this company is trading at an outrageous valuation. And when you look at time sales, it's like insane. Look, the company trading, if you're looking at price to sales, you should have got rid of it at 16, at 30, at 50, at 90, it's 125. Stop looking at the metric because it's not working. So what do you want to look at? What I got wrong with Netflix is I analyzed that company and said, okay, how the hell is this company as big as, you know, Comcast? And it doesn't make sense of how big they're, you know, so I'm comparing them to other cable companies. And what I got wrong is the total addressable market, because it wasn't that Netflix was trying to be Comcast. Every single cable company in the world was trying to be Netflix. And if you look at it that way, it increased its total addressable market by a factor of 10. And that's why the company's where it is today. When you look at Palantir, Palantir has the holy grail. Every Fortune 500 company, even just the oil companies alone, is a $200 billion opportunity. So it looks super expensive right now, but they're one of the only companies that can come in. And on day one, you're going to see the massive productivity gains of what they could do with AI and how they could evolve around their system. So much so that you're having leaders of, who was it? It wasn't Chevron. It's one of the biggest oil companies in the world. Got on stage with him. He didn't get paid and said, I've never seen anything like this. The productivity that we're getting, how we lowered costs tremendously, we're getting more output, we're saving costs, less employees. You know, it was transformational for the business. And when you look at what they could do, this is a company that has a $500 billion total addressable market that most analysts are saying, this is like a $10, $20 billion market. You're wrong, right? So that's why you're looking at Palantir. Plus, they're traveling with the president, which is great because every time he goes to another country, they're going to get the contract. NVIDIA's going to get the contract. All the companies that are traveling with them are going to get the contracts. So, you know, when I look at Palantir, we got that one right because I got Netflix wrong and I analyze it differently.
And
so
that's
again,
back to this discussion of how do you know, right, to change your mind when the facts change, right?
Yeah, because you're going to be wrong. It's embrace it. I mean, embrace it because it's going to make you a better investor. And sometimes that stubbornness comes in. If I had it, you've had it. People say you shouldn't be emotional about stocks. I've been emotional about stocks. You've been emotional about stocks. But you always want to try to get better and focus on those mistakes of what you got wrong, because trust me, you're going to be doing this for the next 20, 30 years. And it's going to help you. And when you and I have this podcast, we're not speaking like we know it all. We're speaking because we messed up a lot in the past and we're trying to teach you, right? So that's, you know, and that's what's better for investors.
Yep. I'm not sure this is going to work, but hang on. Wait, hold on a second. We got to get this recorded for the actual podcast. So hang on a second. Hang on. Is it this one? Where is this? Is it going to go here? We'll go here. We'll record this. And I think this is on. I don't know if I can do this. It's not going to work. I didn't put it on the thing. But anyway, there's a little. Let me just look. Nope, we can't do it. Can't do it. I didn't set it up right. So there you go. It was a great little thing that Frank did. And we kind of put it to music. You know what I was talking about, Frank, right?
Yes, I do know.
Anyway, we'll do it next time. Let's tie it all up with the other side of the coin, right? You talked about some names that, well, you want to buy them because of the research. You want things like, oh, just the tag along feature with the flying riding on the coattails of Trump, like a Palantir and some of these other companies. What about the companies you don't like so much? You know, there's a few of them you mentioned here in a note to me, but I'll kind of throw it out to you. Two of them are retail-ish. I'll call it consumables. By the way, you know, this is the Disciplined Investor podcast. If I ever had a food podcast, you know what I call it?
What?
The Disciplined Ingester.
You should. You know what? You're more passionate about food than you are the markets. Okay, I think your listeners know that.
All right, let's talk about whether it's why you don't like Chipotle, why you don't like Starbucks, why you don't like Salesforce. Let's take the two food ones related first. Let's hit it off with Chipotle.
Chipotle... What they've done is remarkable of how big that company has become. So this isn't like me talking about like, you know, this is a horrible company. Losing this CEO, I think the CEO left at the perfect time. So what I've seen with retailers, and we've been negative on this since probably about $60, 62, and it went higher. It's when it split, and now it's down to not the 52-week low, about below 50 though. This is a name that I'm a big fan, I used to go all the time. I still go sometimes. If you go to Chipotle right now, I can tell you, I can guarantee you that experience is a lot worse than it was 2 years ago. And you're looking at the staff is different. Sometimes they don't have the chicken ready. They don't even fill up the freaking food, which you're paying $15 for a bowl now, which is fill it up. I mean, come on, fill it up. I mean, you want to get some food, right? It's why when you go to, you know, Cracker Barrel, they give you 9 pancakes. You love that stuff. I mean, if you're going to charge higher prices, give them more, and you almost have to beg them to put food in there. There's no lid sometimes. And this, you know, I go to like 3 or 4 different ones, and I hear this from, if you go online and look at surveys and stuff like that, what I do, you'll see the experience is a lot worse. What I see with some of these big retailers is when they hit a certain level, like this company that has, you know, 3,700 stores, what does that mean? Those stores are in the right places. Now what they're doing is they want to open up thousands of more stores, and they're not going to be at the best locations. This is the last step of what every single retailer goes through, because you're fighting for growth. They did have pricing power. Now I'm not sure if they're going to have pricing power going forward, because now it's very expensive to eat there. And it resulted in me changing my you know, my family used to go there. It used to be $50. Now it's like $75, you know? So when you're looking at them opening up more stores, it's a desperation to try to increase growth. But you know, at the end of the day, you already have these at prime locations, and you see this throughout history. If you look at the last 30 years, even Walmart ran into this problem. Want to open up more stores, because you run out of ways to grow your company. And this company is trading at a 40 times forward PE still, right near its 52-week low, about 10% off of it. They don't have the right CEO in there. That guy was a rock star. And for me, you're not getting the consumer experience. The worst thing you could do as a service is raise prices and provide a worse service for everyone. I mean, that's why I think Disney has been, you know, I've been negative on Disney for a very, very, very long time. And you know, rightly so, with the stock coming down from 180 to below 100, starting to get its groove back a little bit. But they got into streaming like this is the greatest thing in the world. They had to get into streaming, Disney. They had no choice, right? Because every part of their business was closed during COVID. Now what's Disney doing is they signed so many people out there to basically the average revenue per user is 60, 70% less than everyone else. But what are they doing? They're going to raise prices. They don't have a lot of new content coming out on this compared to all the great platforms, right? So you're raising prices, you're throwing commercials all over it. So you're raising prices and providing a worse experience for customers, and that's their growth model, right? So when I see that with Chipotle, I just think it's incredibly expensive. The experience isn't that good. You're looking at higher ticket items so that it's less traffic, but they're able to raise prices a little bit more, but the less traffic has got me worried. And I think going forward, it's going to come down a lot more. And same with Starbucks. I mean, that CEO went to Starbucks, right? So you're at Starbucks now, and that stock went up 20%. I could tell you, you know, with people with their coffee, when you tick them off like you did in the morning, where they're pre-ordering, and you go there and it's not ready. That happened to me a couple times. You flip. I mean, it's bad enough not drinking coffee in the morning. Now you're going there and it's not ready. So now what happens is that you lost your customers. And when you lose your customers, now they found another place that's, you know how hard it is to get that customer back? You know, you're talking about something where there's coffee shops on every single corner, right? So they're not, and their growth model was what? China, and China's disaster. So, you know, the writing's on the wall for some of these things. Salesforce, I just think this is a company that have proprietary stuff, the best CRM system in the world. It's catered to the highest end companies in the world. They could charge whatever they want. And now they're like, holy cow, AI could do all this stuff. And now they're going all in on AI. And as they go all in on AI, you have massive competitors that are entering the space, that are in the space with you. Because you don't need to be a code writer now. You can do a lot of this stuff yourself. And the systems that are coming out is a huge threat to them. It's why they just bought, Informatica for $8 billion. That's desperation. That doesn't sound like a company that's growing. And you're seeing it in the numbers. It's also, you know, not a crazy expensive stock, 25 times forward earnings. But now you went from being like this proprietary that everyone needs you to something where you open up the door to massive competition. And I think, you know, now when you have more competition, what does that mean? You have less pricing power. So they used to have tons of pricing power. Now that you don't have that pricing power, I think they're going to be in a little bit of trouble going forward.
Yeah, interesting stuff. I mean, that's what you do. That's where you go. I mean, the big thing about Salesforce that I want to always look at is I've always linked their success and their price potential in the future to the employment situation, right? Until we see like a real runoff that's horrible, because then they sell seats. That's what they sell is they sell seats. But I want to thank you, Frank Curzio, for joining me today for another lively discussion about all things related to markets and investments and all that. And I want to thank my listeners for joining me today for another great episode of the podcast. The information about Frank, his newsletter, his Wall Street Unplugged. You could always get him at Frank Curzio at Curzio or Curzio. What is that? What's your email?
It's Frank at CurzioResearch.com.
Frank at Curzio. I told him he used to say Frank at CurzioResearch.com. Now it's Frank at CurzioResearch.com. You want to hit him up with something or go to his website. We'll have all that information. As a matter of fact, his link to his emails on the episode show notes for episode number 924 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But I did promise this, and I guess we're just going to have to.
It's August 3rd.
Bring this in as we close out.
The Wall Street Unplugged podcast, where I break down the headlines and
And
it's so funny. That is so awesome.
Frank, thanks for joining me. We're going to end on this, and we'll see you real soon.
And tell you what's really moving these markets.
Anyway, that's all we got for this episode. Thanks for joining me again. We'll see you around real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.